You're now listening to The Brian Callen Show with your host, Brian Callen.
Ladies and gentlemen, this is The Brian Callen Show, joined by my colleague, Hunter Motz, which makes it The Brian Callen Hunter Motz Experience.
No,
the big ideas.
No, it doesn't equate, Brian. Damn it. It's still just The Brian
this
Callen
is
Show.
This conversations with Brian Callen. I get all these suggestions online about what to call it.
Well, a lot of people still like Man Thoughts.
Man, you know? This is Man Thoughts, / conversations with Brian Callen, / the Hunter Motz Brian Callen Experience. It doesn't matter. We have Tim Ferriss, one of my favorite people. I've read all three of your books and loved all of them. 4-Hour Chef, 4-Hour Work Week was the first book I read, and then The 4-Hour Body. And I was telling you before we started recording this that I probably recommend that book to anybody who wants to lose weight, get in shape, gain weight, whatever it might be. It's kind of the Bible for all things body. And then the other things I love about it, we've talked about this before, is just how you deconstruct the learning process. The other day, it's funny how often I quote you, and I sound very smart. I was like, look, 20% of your effort usually results in 80% of your results. They were like, how do you know that stuff? I was like, you know what? Just experience. I gave you nothing.
Well, there's that great Einstein quote that creativity is hiding your sources. So,
oh,
you know, there
great.
You go.
There it is. Tim, how are you, buddy?
I'm fantastic, man. Thanks for the kind words. I met my first reader who lost more than 200 pounds on the slow-carb diet a few weeks ago, which just blew my brain.
Damn, man.
Yeah. It's been wild. I'm hoping to do an updated, probably not expanded, but somewhat updated and semi-expanded version of the 4-Hour Body with case studies, just because a lot of the chapters that were very controversial at the time, like the cold exposure, for instance, and things like that, have since been validated many, many times over.
We'll talk about that. Yeah, I was talking to Rogan about that because they were talking about there's a chamber if you're injured or whatever, where athletes will get in there. And it's 300 degrees below zero or something. It's not that.
They just cryogenically freeze you like
literally. Well, yeah, that would burn your skin. But there's some kind of crazy. What is the very cold ice? Dry ice.
Dry ice, or are you talking about liquid nitrogen?
Yeah,
or?
Liquid nitrogen, where they blast you parts of your body with this liquid nitrogen, but they rotate you so your skin doesn't get burned, and apparently it brings down inflammation. Is that, I don't know if that's what you were talking about.
gives you a nice permatan while you're at it.
Yeah. Well, it's all this extreme, you know.
Yeah, what they do is they freeze dry the fat, and then they can just chisel it off. It comes off in great sheets, like the Antarctic.
Well, the thing is, there are so many, there's still, like, Western medicine and science is an amazing thing, and it's caught up with a lot of diseases and things. But there are still some really interesting mysteries out there that are, for example, chronic pain, back pain, injuries that seem not to go away. And you have a whole section about that, you know. I mean, and you tried it. I mean, there's stem cell therapy. There's now Regenikine, which is supposed to sort of bring down inflammation that I've heard athletes swear by. There's all kinds of different things. There's just deep tissue massage. There's chiropractic adjustments. What in all your experiments and stuff, how do you deal with chronic injury and scar tissue and stuff?
Well, I think that there are a lot of fancy technological approaches and what people might view as sophisticated approaches. So I've done all the crazy shit, of course. I've done the stem cells from Israel that have been grown flown over and combined with bone morphogenic protein, which I don't recommend, and then throw in some, you know, IGF-1 or growth hormone for good measure.
Sure.
And I've also done, for instance, PRP, which is very promising, and that is
platelet-rich plasma,
right? Yeah. Where they take out your own blood, spin it in a centrifuge, take out the growth factors, and then inject those locally. But the most important place to start, I think, is just basic mobility work and rehab. And you'll find that, for instance, if you're sitting at a desk a lot, as many people do these days, your posture leads to this sort of contracted, constrained pec position, that you'll get back pain. And what do people do? They'll have a massage therapist work on their back, and the back pain never seems to go away. And the reason is they need to open up their chests.
So right.
You could just have someone like a Kelly Starrett or even someone who's familiar with something like the Gokel method, which is about posture and walking and basically emulating people in what you might consider third world or primitive cultures and how they walk with, say, 100 pounds on their head every single day and don't appear to have back pain. How does that work? So really returning to, I think, a fundamental basics before you start doing the fancy stuff. And that's true for low testosterone as well. You'll find in tech, for whatever reason, and I have my theories, a lot of people suffer from low testosterone.
Really?
And like chronically extremely low testosterone. I mean, guys that you would look at and you'd be like, oh, that guy goes to the gym, fit fella. And they have testosterone levels of you like 200, 250 when they should be in the 600, 700s. And you could do hormone replacement therapy. You could look at micronutrient deficiencies. Selenium is very common. Copper. And you could do all of that. However, I recently took a month off of alcohol. And it's just amazing. Like, you stop fucking drinking 3 to 4 glasses of wine a night, going out to social functions, and shazam.
Yeah,
you know,
man.
100 things remedy themselves.
Sleep, water, good whole food, and exercise.
Yep. Yeah.
That shit can be – and just kind of dealing with stress the way you should. That mm-hmm. that shit can – that can – yeah, that can have – that can give you a boner. That can bring your dick back. All right?
Good food gives you a boner. That's your next merchandise line.
That's my t-shirt I'm going to sell. Good food gives you a boner.
All you do is you sell truffles, but you like, you know, mark them up 200% because they have like the gives you a boner stamp
exactly,
on it.
Exactly. What is your theory on why tech people have such low testosterone?
There are a few theories, and these are just pure speculation for the most part. Number one would be, it's actually not diet. I thought that I could narrow it down to diet, but living in San Francisco, a lot of techies take decent care of themselves. Yeah. They're also the mutants who live on Mountain Dew and, you know, nachos, and
sure.
That's it. But the vast majority of people I know who are at an executive level actually consume really, really high quality food. So I couldn't pin it to that. I think that one of the main causes, and again, this is pure speculation on my part, but I think that blue light from laptop screens, computer screens, late at night, negatively affects hormone production. I think it affects everything from circadian rhythm, certainly, which is why I use a free app called Flux, which is very cool, which will actually it will change the wavelength of the light emitted by your laptop after sunset according to your time zone.
Wow.
So you can download that.
Well, we had Russell Foster, who is a sleep scientist from Oxford University, and he was talking about blue light. And he said that one of the biggest mistakes you can make before you go to sleep is to be staring at your computer or your phone right before you go to bed, because it actually affects your sleep patterns.
Well, he was the guy who discovered basically the photoreceptors that have nothing to do with vision and are just responsible for circadian rhythms.
Yeah.
But that's the thing, is he was actually talking specifically about that we didn't really fully know what the effects of people, people checking that stuff all the time.
Yeah, so I think that that is a very likely candidate. And if you look at, let's say, screens affecting sleep, well, that's affecting, I'm sure, many different things, including how the brain interprets these light signals as a cue for the circadian schedule, melatonin production, of course. But then you start looking at how all of these hormones interplay. And what if, for instance, I mean, of course, hormone production like testosterone is dictated in large part by circadian rhythm and sleep cycles. That's why if you ever get blood testing to track your health, you have to do it same day of the week, same time of day. This is something that people...
Oh, that's interesting. We might be losing time. Yeah.
Yeah, and because if you, for instance, have a testosterone test on a Monday, can you hear me?
Yeah, go ahead. Ooh,
can you hear me okay?
Yeah, we can hear you now.
Can you hear me? Okay, sorry about that. Yeah, we should be good. If you have a testosterone test on, say, a Monday after a weekend of drinking, and you do it at 10 a.m., hypothetically, mm-hmm. Your testosterone is probably going to be depressed substantially. And then if you were to do it a month later on a Friday after a week of not drinking and do it early in the morning, you might have twice your testosterone levels.
Wow.
Now, vice versa, what might happen, right? Everything's fine. You just switch those. Now you go in and suddenly your testosterone appears like it's been cut in half, and your doctor only sees you once a year, which is why you should get blood tests every quarter at a very minimum, and they put you on testosterone replacement therapy. And now you become dependent on exogenous testosterone. You're fucked. So that's a
real dependency, isn't it? I know athletes who really screw themselves up with that over long-term use, because when they tried to come off it, they had real problems.
Yeah, that's why. I mean, there are power lifters, a lot of the guys at Westside Barbell, you know, who've been on steroids for 20, 30 years without cycling. And
wow.
you can use post-cycle therapy and other techniques to get off of these external supplements, but you don't want to put yourself in that position to start with. So the point being that even 2 hours can make a huge difference in testosterone production based on a normal sleep cycle. So if you start getting hit with this blue light, my theory is I think it's related to luteinizing hormone, which in sort of a synthetic form is often administered, or an analog is HCG. So people talk about the HCG diet, so human chorionic gonadotropin is either injected or taken sublingually, and that triggers the Leydig cells in the testes to produce testosterone. So all these things are so interrelated. The body is so sensitive that when you take this extremely abnormal late night blue light and subject your brain to that for hours at a time, I think that really is the biggest culprit. I think it's one of the biggest.
It sounds pretty interesting to me. It makes sense. I mean, I had a doctor explain that the body's basically a sack of biochemicals, all interrelating with each other. So you can certainly throw those.
Here's the real question. Why don't we put it to the test? I mean, would you like us to connect you with Russell Foster? And I mean, maybe this is an experiment that you guys could set up.
Yeah, I'd love to chat with him.
Yeah, we'll do that. Thank you, Hunter.
Oh, no worries. We're advancing science at the same time.
Damn right, that's what we do on the Brian Callen's Hunter Mott's Experience /conversation/big ideas/Tim Ferriss.
There's really only 4 or 5 words that you can use in the name of a podcast, experience.
I'm literally going to go through all of it because I just find the Brian Callen show to be so egocentric, it kills me, it embarrasses me.
Well, I had the same issue, right? Because I'm trying to figure out, I just launched this podcast, and I'm trying to figure out what to call it. One of my friends is trying to incept everybody to call it Tim Tim Talk Talk because he knew I would hate that.
So Tim he's like, Tim Talk Talk.
So he's successfully convinced half of my fans that that's actually the name of the show. And
what do you call it? That's hilarious.
I'm calling it the Tim Ferriss Show, but like you said, it comes off as so goddamn egocentric because I was like, I should call it something else. The Tim Ferriss Experience, then it's going to be people are going to think I'm riding, Joe Rogan's and I don't want to be.
But you do have a name. I mean, I do think your name has credibility, so you kind of get away with it. I'm just a fucking stand-up comic, man. I mean, at least you've gone out there and really done the experiments. You've written 3 books, and they're big books. I mean, you put in your time, man. I mean, you're on the board of different things. I mean, you've earned some credibility there, my friend. I mean, this is the reason I ask you all these questions. I mean, so in that sense, yes, it's the Tim Ferriss Show, and I'm going to learn. What do you talk about
like
in your podcast?
I do like Tim Talk Talk, though. It sounds very sort of like Indonesian or something like that.
Tim Tim Talk Talk. It sounds Vietnamese or Indonesian. Yeah, that's true. Tim
sounds
Tim Talk
like
Talk.
A delicious dish. to get it.
Oh my God,
shot.
Yeah. Do you want whiter brown rice with your Tim Tim Talk Talk?
what do you talk about on your podcast?
Well, I had so much fun over the last few years being on podcasts like this one, as opposed to going on, let's say, the Today Show, or not to mention names, but the constrained short form television format, which is just so exhausting, and you really can't dig deep into topics, that I fantasized about doing my own podcast for about 2 years. And I always put it off. And we talked about this. Remember when I was hitting you with technical questions and you're like, I don't deal with this.
I don't know anything.
No, but you did it the right way as opposed to trying to figure out all of the weeds and the gears and so on yourself. You jumped into it. And I wanted to geek out on the tech, so I pushed it off. And eventually, launched this thing as an experiment. And the basic premise of the show is just trying to take the 80-20 principle, which you mentioned earlier. What are the 20% of results or 20% of inputs, right? So techniques, resources, training tools, whatever it might be, mm-hmm. that these world-class people in different fields use to get 80% or more of the results. So that would range from, I have tech investors, I have chess prodigies, I've got people who are filmmakers all across the board, different people who are world-class at what they do, and the podcast is dissecting that.
I love that. Mm-hmm. Wow. What is it called then? It's called The Tim Ferriss Show.
Yeah, it's just The Tim Ferriss Show. We have five episodes so far, and it's doing really well.
Yeah, five episodes. What a pup!
yeah, I know.
Whatever,
I know. Young pup these days.
See, I'll be listening. Goes, I guarantee I'll be listening to it.
Yeah, Brian, as opposed to going for quality, he really just goes for quantity. That's why, you know, this is what kills me. By the way, like, you know, I'm booking people like Jared Diamond, and Brian brings on porn stars. Like my parents,
Asa, I had Asa Akira. I know.
Oh, I've never heard of her. Yes, I have. Okay. Did I say that out loud?
She was actually great. She wrote this book called Insatiable, and I got. She was very, very forthcoming about just the insanity of the lifestyle.
Yeah.
That woman is like a professional athlete.
She is a... I had never seen her videos the night before. I go, let me click on this. Yeah, exactly. Listen, I'm a porn aficionado. I'm not going to, you know, deny that. But so much so that I can't watch porn anymore. Nothing. I'm dead to it now. But I watched some of her her videos, and I was like, whoa! Easy. That's impressive. I mean, she is a true athlete. God bless Asa Akira. That's all.
Well, you know, all right. Since we're on porn, I took last month off of porn as well with my alcohol. And part of the reason was, like you said, you know, it's like it's dead to me. You get to the point where you're so unimpressed.
So true.
By the most, just like
horrifically
ridiculous
gang bang with, you know, you're like,
and you're just like, really, like, don't we have any more orifices to add to this, like, can we stick a few more things in there? And so you get to this point where I was really afraid that like normal sex would become like watching paint dry,
right?
And
try being married, man. You're like, oh,
yeah,
Jesus.
Well, right, exactly. Yeah, yeah. So I worried about this, and so I took all of last month off.
Good man.
All of last month off, that implies that experiment is now over, and you're going back.
Well, Tim, he's not wearing pants right now. I guarantee. Yeah, this is porn for him. This is intellectual porn. You know, look, Brian Gallant.
Man thoughts. Ways that go.
Man thoughts. Here comes a Vaseline. This is my dick, everybody.
Oh my god.
I'm kind of obsessed. I just listened to, didn't read, but listened to C.S. Lewis's The Screwtape Letters. I don't know if you know that, but
that is a great book.
Isn't that a great book?
It's about a transition from porn to
C.S.
Lewis, right?
Well, Screwtape. Well, Screwtape is a demon, a senior demon in the hierarchy of hell, and he's writing letters to his young nephew, who is a junior demon who is trying to corrupt a soul, a human being. And it does have a Christian bent. I'm not a churchgoer or a Christian, but I will say that it's an incredible it's an incredible dissection of how we think as human beings and sort of how we deal with temptation. And we all know we're doing the wrong thing when we do certain things. It's a waste of time to be hunched over like a jumbo shrimp on your computer whacking off. I'm just full of shame at the end of that situation. I'm like, look at me, I'm disgusting. Look, I'm 47. What's wrong with me? I literally go, well, at least I got testosterone. I can still get it up. I mean, I say shit like that to myself, and I crawl in the bed. My wife is literally sleeping like, what a scumbag. I'm like, I have children. Look at me. So I, you know, it's a terrible, terrible state of affairs.
So get worse. It gets worse, is what you're saying.
Of course, it gets worse. You know, I thought the older I get, the creepier I get, for Christ's sake. But you want to kind of avoid that. And one of the great things about the Screwtape Letters is that it's such a human. It's sort of look at the human mind. It's such a dissection of the human mind. And C.S. Lewis he lived a life and said, look, the temptation and sort of vice plays so many different roles. Pride. The minute you start saying I'm religious or I'm humble, that becomes its own vice, you know, because I'm better than all these other people. And he has a great quote. He said that when you know you've arrived, the one thing you want to avoid is if an artist can actually, the devil's saying, don't let them be the kind of artist, because they're very rare, who can create something beautiful, stand back and enjoy it as much as if someone else had done it. Take no pride in the fact that he did it. In other words, you were just sort of a vessel, a radio, a frequency that channeled this. And I have to say, I take that, you know, not to get too lofty, but certainly stand up for me. I was talking about this. I've been doing it so long that after a while, you write things you know are going to work, but they're not really you, or they're not honest. And so
I've heard this multiple times.
Yeah.
It's so fascinating to
me.
Anyway, I'm not to interrupt, but just being the vessel.
That's very important, because for me, I literally start by asking questions like, what am I ashamed of? What am I afraid of? Who would I rather be? Those kinds of things. How do I raise my son in 2014? I don't even know what a man means anymore with all this technology. Those are the kind of questions, and then the comedy just comes. If you start trying to be funny, what you're really trying to do is manipulate an audience. You're trying to lie. You're trying to pull a fast one, and you're doing it so that they laugh at you. Instead of just expressing yourself as honestly and as raw as you possibly can, and you will get what you that the result will be a positive one regardless. And that kind of trust and keeping sort of that purity of expression or working for that is crucial. And you've got to remind yourself and inspire yourself to stay on that track with great works of literature, in my opinion, like the Screwtape Letters. Having friends like Hunter keeps me on the straight and narrow because Hunter's a high moralist.
Because when I have a little zap collar, and every time Brian touches himself,
my dick, damn, naughty dick, yeah. Naughty dick. Anyway, so but that's
I would highly recommend people check out the Screwtape Letters. And like you, I'm not religious, but. Mm-hmm. I find the pairing of someone who is extremely brilliant and an incredible writer like C.S. Lewis with someone like Bertrand Russell, who is effectively the opposite, to be amazing. And you can actually alternate reading those types of books. Mm-hmm. And I think that it's so incredible. And I have an answer for you. So a man in this day and age is, I think, just a sort of physical appendage from porn websites.
that's basically it. Great. Yeah.
It is an ad consumption animal that is physically secured to porn websites via broadband.
Yeah, it just taps into that terrible part of your brain.
Ad consumption machine.
That makes sense. Just a sack of oil. It's just a consuming.
It's like, wow, I can lose 20 pounds by drinking grapefruit juice. All right, click. Like, oh my God, Ron Jeremy has the 745th. Penis enlargement product, click. You know, like.
Exactly.
So in other words, the meaning of life is to give the internet meaning.
Yeah, that's right.
Ooh, that's very meta.
Certainly. Well, you're dealing with Hunter Motz, who speaks 28 languages or whatever.
But the thing that you were saying about the idea that you're just a radio for great ideas, Elizabeth Gilbert has that great TED talk about your muse and how we used to have this idea of the muse, and that, you know, whether you wrote well or you wrote poorly on a particular day had nothing to do with you. And there was this great detachment where it's like, Muse didn't show up today. Like, that's okay. It'll show up tomorrow.
Stephen Pressfield talks about that. Somerset Maugham, one of my favorite writers, used to say, the Muse hits me at 8 o'clock every morning. In other words, I just sit down and that's when I do it. Mm-hmm. Flannery O'Connor, a wonderful writer, died at 39 from MS. But she said, I sit at my typewriter at 5:30 in the morning, not to write, but in case something happens. Mm-hmm. It's an act of faith. So you show up. And I heard Neil Simon in my acting class, of all things, talk about that at length. Mm-hmm. He goes, I just feel like the little man that climbs the stairs and sits in his room and just, you know, writes, and most of the time I fail. Mm-hmm. But I keep showing up until something happens.
Yeah.
So there's no, I love that. I love that process, the idea that every time, you know, I think Steve Jobs, you gave me that YouTube video, said, when you realize that the world is made, everything you see around you, this thing we call life, and all these things are made by people that are no smarter than you are, you'll never be the same. It's just effort. It's just technique. It's learning where to place your energy, as you say. What 20% of your energy do you need to place where? Those are the kinds of things. That's the mystery that starts to break down. But I'm now kind of, as I get older, I think maybe because I have children, I'm obsessed with this idea of morality and ethics and the responsibility of being a moral human being, a human being that really, because there is language for it, there is criteria for it. And we live in a very relativist age, I suppose. But you have to be careful when you are an atheist or you are, you know, a humanist or a universal humanist, because what happens, I think, we owe a debt to religion to the extent that I think If you're not careful, I think religion, and specifically the Judeo-Christian ethic, gives us the idea that everybody's of the same moral worth. Monotheism, the idea that we come from one God, isn't so much that everybody else who's a polygamist, who believes in a polytheist is like
Brian,
a Hindu,
was
is
that
a bad person.
Freudian
yes,
slip?
Yes, it was. Yes, it was. And by the way, I love when I start lecturing. My voice gets very much, I should be speaking this way, as I'm from England. Anyway.
David Attenborough being channeled through the radio frequency.
Of course, and now it's David Attenborough, ladies and gentlemen, about religion.
But David, the voice of David Attenborough, but with the perversion of Brian Callen.
I very much like porn. I like taking my penis in hand and jacking off. That's my David. Sorry, David Attenborough. It's kind of an outrageous thing to do. But the idea just that you've got that religion kind of gave us this idea that we're all of the same moral worth, which is not rational. If you look at a homeless homeless person and you look at a genius, you're going to say that genius, I want that guy should be alive and makes the world a better place, and that guy over there, well, he's kind of a bump on the log. There's a tendency in history, and societies have always delineated. But the one thing that Christianity and well, for that matter, Judaism, but the Judeo-Christian ethic gave to us was the idea that no matter what, if I kill a homeless person, I'm going to jail for life, whether I kill a homeless person or hunter. That's not necessarily actually rational. It's not utilitarian. You can make
it
the
is
argument,
utilitarian, though. I think that's the whole point. I mean, it's also in the Declaration of Independence, right?
But that was influenced by, even
it
though
may have
they
been
weren't
influenced,
you know,
but there's actually, I read a great article the other day by this constitutional scholar, and he was saying, listen, the idea that all men are created equal, it's not about whether that's true or false. It's about
ideal.
That it's a useful idea. Because, yeah. I mean, that's the whole point. Look at what happens to a society when you start deciding that some people are better than others.
Yes.
Well, Nazi Germany.
Like, exactly.
Inevitably.
Eugenics.
Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, all those kinds of things. Euthanasia. I mean, all those things. Why have all these severely retarded children? They're just creating space. They're taking up space. We have this interesting moral revulsion or affiliation.
But it's very practical. I mean, you know, William James, who is, you know, I think William James is brilliant and overlooked, and he's really the father of American psychology and philosophy and all this sort of stuff. But, you know, he was an advocate of
yes. I don't know anything about
it. But he was an advocate of pragmatism, right? The point is that people look at the idea that all men are created equal, and they spend their time arguing about, is that true? Is that not true? One guy can run faster than another guy because, you know, slow twitch muscles, fast twitch muscles, and all that sort of stuff. That's not what's interesting. What's interesting is, what are the practical consequences of committing to that idea? What society does that lead to? What does that people, you know, cause them to do? I mean, and that was the whole point why we wrote The Straight-A Conspiracy, right? It's, you know, the idea that people are born smart is the terrible thing. It's not, is it true that there may one day be a math gene? No. But if you buy into the idea that some people are born smart, then it screws up your entire process.
That's interesting.
You know?
So you're talking about an ideal. It's a pragmatic ideal.
It's a pragmatic ideal,
also,
yeah.
I would also add to that agreed on James, that just to bring it to another level, I saw a bumper sticker not long ago here in the Bay Area where I live, and it said, the fool believes religion to be true, the wise man believes religion to be false, the politician believes religion to be useful. And I was like, whoa, that's
Jesus.
Now, granted, that was among like 1,700 other bumper stickers, all of which conflicted. It was like the end war, kill Cheney, coexist. I was like, I don't even know what to take away from this.
I love those. Yeah,
it's like you got to pick one thing to go after.
Well,
folks.
it's basically that's a car. That's just a rolling fuck you. Those kind of cars. They're just hostile.
Yeah, let me just I live in Berkeley. I'm a pacifist. Let me piss off everybody that I can.
It's great.
But what's also
but,
so, yeah.
No, where I was just going to lead with that is that I find religion very fascinating. It's very difficult as someone who did not grow up as a churchgoer, even though I went to an Episcopal school at one point and went to chapel almost every morning. It was required.
Wow. I didn't do any of that.
Yeah, so I had a bit of that exposure, and then lived in Japan and had all this exposure to Buddhism and so on. But there's a great book that I can recommend to people called The Year of Living Biblically, which is hilarious. It is about a writer, A.J. Jacobs, who writes for Esquire, who spent a year trying to follow all of the rules of the Old and New Testament.
I heard about this. Yeah.
It is a hilarious book because he's trying to check off all these rules. And for instance, he had to stone adulterers. Well, how do you stone adulterers and not get thrown in jail? So he realized the loophole was, and keep in mind, by this point in the book, he's in New York City. He has white robes on, a beard down to his navel. And he realized that the loophole was they didn't specify the size of the stones. So he got a pocket full of pebbles and went to Central Park and would walk up to guys and ask them if they were adulterers. And one guy was like, yeah, what the fuck are you going to do about it? And he took out a little pebble and flicked it into his chest and then took off running. And that was – and he checked it off. But the point being –
outstanding.
You know, he grew up as – a Jew, but as he put it, you know, I am to Judaism what the Olive Garden is to Italian. And he went to Brown, and eventually he had his first kid, and like you, probably started to wonder, holy shit, like, how am I going to raise this creature as an ethical being? What does that even mean?
Yeah,
and
especially if you don't have, I didn't grow up with a religious tradition.
Well, exactly. So it's like, do you use that as a framework just to get things started, or do you not? And that's what sparked the entire book. And I learned more from religion from that book than just about any other book I've ever read. It's very, very well researched because it was delivered in a very palatable, digestible, entertaining format. And I mean, that's a real challenge. And I think that's something that you mentioned the 4-hour body. I mean, I spent 3 years on that trying to make it so that something that potentially dense and intimidating would have storytelling as a component. AJ does a spectacular job. I highly recommend the book.
And it seems like what you're saying about the book is that it doesn't just tell you the what of religion, but the why of religion. You start to understand why it makes sense, what are the consequences, what are the benefits, and all of that sort of stuff. And
Or why it doesn't make sense.
Yeah,
So in AJ's case, you know, it's what I found so compelling about it is if it's a first-person narrative that explores his struggles with answering these questions and the subject matter through the lens of someone who is, number one, a self-experimenter, but number two, a very good researcher, right? So you're along for the journey.
Right.
As opposed to...
Are you hearing that, by the way? Are you hearing his mic? I think just back off a little bit, Tim, because your mic is... There you go. You have such a strong, powerful voice. Your peas.
I like God.
I was going for it. I was trying to swallow this thing.
There you go.
The Screwtape Letters, or say even Bertrand Russell, you know, he has a book called Why I Am Not a Christian, right? And so both of those are coming into the conversation predetermined, whereas AJ is coming into it completely undecided. And that's what I found so fascinating.
We had John Durant on recently, who wrote the Paleo Manifesto, and you know he was talking about basically how the Mosaic Law is essentially basic microbiology. Like, a lot of those laws,
washing all the time, not eating certain food, animals that eat flesh and things like that.
Yeah. And I think that's the thing, is I think people who come in like Bertrand Russell or like C.S. Lewis with a strong agenda of religion is either worthless or, you know, or is the only way that you can live, are missing out, because there are things of value to be found in a secular perspective, and there are things of value to be found within the rules of religion. Like, some of those rules are actually still quite useful and adaptive today.
As you were talking, I was just reminded of the Israelites and John Durant talking about how when they would come in and conquer and they would put everybody to the sword, they'd kill everybody, but they would keep the virgins for themselves, because you can't have sex with a woman who's had sex with another man. You might catch a disease. So just fuck the virgins. Sorry we had to slaughter your entire village. Now we're going to fuck the virgins. That's how you don't catch a disease. Carry on reading Deuteronomy, everyone. You know, so you're right. There are certain things you might want to not follow. The Israelites were, you know, not the nicest guys in the world in some contexts.
Right.
So, yeah.
But I think that's, you know, like so much of what religion is about and what all of those codes are about, it's basically about long-term thinking and excluding distractions, right? That's really...
100%.
You know?
That's kind of... That in a way is the other thing I've been thinking about, is so much of it is excluding distractions. So much of, you know, I really think that a lot of life is learning what not to think about, right? Where not to place your energy. There's a lot of useless. I mean, if you really listen to people talk, there is a whole lot of gossip. There's just a whole lot of talk about what could have gone right, what isn't going right. None of that stuff really helps you.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's a great deal of distraction, like we were talking about. I mean, you know, the fact that the internet, and there's a lot of good to the internet. There's a lot of bad. There's a lot of distraction. Porn not being just one on a long list of things, right? So I think that you're right. I think that it really depends on what you're after. And maybe that's the first thing. Really isolate what the hell you're trying to do.
But I also think if you look at it, most of us want the same things. You know, I mean, you can go to, you know, the mountains of Afghanistan, or you can go to Los Angeles. Everybody wants a wife and a family and kids and a house, and they want to have work that's meaningful.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, they want dignity. That's ultimately what everybody wants.
Yeah.
Well, I think that to come to back to what you were saying, Brian, about what not to think about, I think that in a secular society, part one of the largest problems you have, and granted it's pretty high up on Maslow's hierarchy of needs, but that doesn't make it any less difficult. In fact, I think it makes it more difficult in the sense that if you're missing food and you need food, you know exactly what you need to do. If you're missing shelter and you need shelter,
yeah,
you know exactly what your priority is. Whereas when you get up into more of the fuzzy fulfillment type category of problem, then you have a million paradox of choice issues, right? It's kind of like walking into Safeway and you're like, I just want to buy a toothpaste. Why do I have to suddenly look at 100 different types of toothpaste
That's right.
to decide which labels are bullshit and which are not, and which I should buy and which is worth the price and which is not? It's a,
right.
It contributes to decision fatigue, which is has been studied pretty extensively, and how if you waste your sort of decision hit points on these meaningless decisions, then you fuck up the big decisions.
Yeah.
So how do you create it as an experiment, for instance, if you are an atheist or call yourself agnostic or whatever, if you don't have this nice binary set of rules that religion provides in most cases, how do you quell that paradox of choice? And what I noticed, for instance, last month, no alcohol. Well, that makes choosing social functions really, really easy, mm-hmm. right? And I don't have to really give any explanation because you struggle with kind of declining things, right? It's like, I don't want to be a dick, like, that guy's my friend or whatever. Oh, he came to my wedding. God. And there are all these different social contracts and obligations. And just like saying sorry if they're like, hey, want to come to a pork dinner? And you're like, sorry, I don't eat pork. You know, it would be like, hey, want to come out to ball? No, I'm not drinking this month. They're like, okay, no problem. Done. End of story.
Right.
And it just made – it decreased my stress so dramatically to have
– It simplified things, right?
Yeah. A handful of these rules.
Yeah.
It was really, really a pretty enlightening – no, that's too dramatic a term. It was a very valuable experience to have.
I think there's a tendency that you should be moving in that direction as you get older, to kind of downscale. You don't need that much, right? You just don't.
But that's also because, I mean, you know, you've experienced the other choice. You know,
very much so.
There's
in spades.
Yeah, and a friend of mine who was raised as a modern Orthodox Jew, he likes a quote from the Babylonian Talmud.
Of course. And it has to be the Babylonian Talmud.
But there's a line in there that there is a place where a repentant stands that a righteous man cannot. The point is that once you've gone down the other path and experienced what you do when you break the rule, you really understand why the value of the rule is there, and you commit to it at a level that is much, much deeper than someone who has always been a goody two-shoes.
I always wonder if when I see people who are really out of shape, I always think to myself, man, I wish you knew what it felt like to be in shape.
Mm-hmm.
That sort of when you eat well and you feel clean, you feel strong, you feel energized, you feel clear. And I always wonder when I see somebody who's really religious and in command of all their appetites, I always wonder, man, I wonder how they look at me. They must just be like, look at that degenerate walking across the street there. You know, I wonder if they are, you know, but that's probably part of what drives ascetics and those kinds of people to walk that spiritual path. Well, it is a life of self-restriction.
So then let's find it out. Brian Callen, are you willing to take the Tim
Fuck
Ferriss
no!
no porn for a month challenge?
That's actually easy. I believe it or not, I don't really indulge in porn anymore.
That's and is your life better for that?
That was so unconvincing. I don't know.
I know. I kind of went
so timid,
and depressing. And depressing. Like, I don't really want porn anymore. Yeah. Well, you know, I don't know. I'm more into the Screwtape Letters. I have to say, but then again, I'm 47. I am more and more into this sort of idea of doing things because they don't feel good. Like, I like to box. I'm boxing now with this Wayne McCullough, who is a world champion. Jeez. And I just like getting in there because it's, you know, it's a language I'm not fluent in, man, to say the least. And getting hit and getting, you know, and he just kind of holds mitts and throws punches back. But man, oh man, I just enjoy the fact that I feel like a clumsy oaf in there, and I'm very athletic, ladies and gentlemen. I mean, for me to feel like an oaf is outrageous. I'm a dancer out there.
Yeah.
But I think that there is a great deal of value in sort of, you know, learning a language that you're not so good
but
at.
That's the difference between pleasures and gratifications,
very
right?
Very much so.
My Mihai Csikszentmihalyi and, you know, Martin Seligman, they talk about how there are pleasures, which are things like eating ice cream, watching porn, these very short-term things, but they're not sustainable sources of happiness. At a certain point, you know, after the third time you've jerked off to dirty, dirty, filthy porn, you aren't satisfied anymore.
Speak for yourself, but I know what you mean, Hunter. I know what you mean.
But learning new things, gratifications, you know, challenging yourself, getting better and all of that sort of stuff is a limitless sort of source of joy. Like your pleasure doesn't diminish, it gets greater.
And Tim, talk about this a little bit. I mean, I think there's a real – the biggest problem that I see is that there are a lot of people that just don't know where to place their energy. So what happens is they end up just creating a lot of either drama or noise or just energy around something, a subject. And I always kind of want to – like I watch people on a plane and they're reading these gossip mags. And I always think to myself, man, there's so much – to read, there's so much to do, there's so much to think about. But how do you really say that to somebody who isn't able to or has never really, I don't know. I mean, it's kind of difficult. It's hard. I wish there was a book like that to kind of move people in the direction of what they specifically are supposed to do. But I mean, listen.
It's called Man's Search for Meaning by Viktor Frankl.
Yeah. Yeah, that's thank you.
That's a good one. That's also, I mean, that's a heavy read.
It is a heavy read.
That's a very good book. I think that if I were to take a completely separate approach to the same challenge or same problem, I would have someone read a book called The Magic of Thinking Big, which is a spectacularly good book.
Wow.
And it would fall into the sort of pop psychology realm. But I think that part of the reason many people are seemingly distracted all the time, or seemingly indecisive all the time, overwhelmed by the 30 things they could be doing, is that their goals are impotent in a sense. Mm-hmm. They feel that they're not capable of great things, of big things, of exciting things. So the goals that they have are not exciting enough to compel them to really take one direction and choose one thing. Does that make sense?
And it does. It does.
So it's like if your prize at the end of the rainbow is sort of a trip to Ohio, and I've been to Ohio, love Ohio, but
yeah.
Like Ohio versus like, all right, when I do X, I'm going to take a week-long trip through the Greek islands on a catamaran. Your ability to jump over or run through hurdles as you hit them will be very, very different.
Right.
And I think
because you've got that sort of spectacular image in your mind that's kind of pulling you.
That's right. Direction. And when people have resigned themselves to doing what they believe is sort of in quotation marks realistic by like average American standards, if you're in the U.S., for instance, they're just not excited, and I think it's a lack of excitement more than anything that leads people to a sense of having very little meaning or direction. And it sounds
and
very superficial,
but you said something else that I liked, and I think it was in your book. By the way, make sure you stand back from the mic because you're still popping your peas, but don't worry. You said something that I thought was really interesting. I think it was you said keep your goals. You know, when people make these 10-year long-term goals, they're not as realistic. Set your goals for 3 months, 6 months, 9 months, a year. Was that in your book, Tim? Were you talking about something like
that?
Yeah.
Yeah, it was. It was.
I like that.
Yeah, talking about really setting near-term goals so that you can build the momentum to do big things. And I think that's another issue. You see it very commonly. I'm in Silicon Valley. I'm very involved with startups. I mean, all the way from sort of Twitter to Uber to Evernote, a lot of these right. these different companies. And they succeed because they don't try to boil the ocean in the beginning, right? And I think that whether it's stand-up comedy, writing, building a huge company, you start off by doing a few small things right or developing a few small habits that you follow consistently,
right?
And that is aided by having three to six month goals and then working backwards and ensuring that the sort of what you want to have, what you want to do, who you want to be, goals are defined for those time periods. So after 6 months, like what do you want to have? What do you want to do? And then developing a very practical way of calculating what those cost, right? So a lot of people, not to go too far into the 4-hour work week stuff, but I think it's very relevant, have these vague dreams of retirement. And they think they're going to sail a sailboat around the world or retire to Florida, whatever it might be. And they've never actually stress test these rewards, if that makes sense.
Yeah, right? It's interesting.
They've never taken a weekend to spend 48 hours on a boat. It's like you don't want to predicate all the sacrifices you're making for the next 15 years in a job that you hate on something that you have not tested.
You might hate being on a fucking boat, you know?
Which is really common. And so you find these, let's say, the quarter life crisis, when a lot of people graduate from school, midlife crisis, retirement crisis, where people hit that point where they're physically incapable of sustaining their workload. They want to retire and they realize, oh my God, you know, I've been chasing an illusion for the last 30 years.
God, I see that. It's like that. I climbed to the top of this wall. It took me scraps and I got there, and it was the wrong wall, or I don't like the view. That saying in Hollywood.
So the 3 to 6 months allows you to repeatedly revisit the validity of your goals, and to
which is also another way of getting to know. I think when you start dilating on what you want, you get a closer sense of who you are. I mean, that's kind of the best way to really. I mean, if you really want to know who a man is, figure out what he really wants.
But Tim is also saying is that, you know, what you really want is seen through the lens of what you think is possible. And that's why it's so important to make sure that your assumptions about what is possible are right.
Well, I enrolled my kids into the Montessori schools. And after reading The Second Machine Age, we had these MIT professors on. They were just talking about the number of creative people and innovative people that came out of the Montessori program. I just heard that and I went, wow, that's something to look at. And I went toward the school and I noticed that every single kid, and I'm talking about from preschool to, this is an elementary school, to third grade or whatever, they were just completely engrossed in what they were doing. And not only that, but when I went around and asked them with the teacher what they were doing, they understood the logic behind the math that they were doing. They understood why 1500 was 1500, how it related to 1000 and 500 and things like that. And they do it with tools and things like that. And I said, how do you start with a kid who's a pain in the ass? And they said, we don't do anything. We just let – sometimes there was one kid who just laid there. He wasn't willing to do a thing. We just let him lie there. And pretty soon we noticed, though, that he was, of course, because he was a human being, curious about a certain thing. And we just allowed him to kind of follow his curiosity and then gently nudged him in the direction we wanted him to go. You build on – you start slowly. Like you said, don't try to boil the ocean. Start slowly. See where your curiosity leads you, and then go from there. And it was a very, very interesting thing. And I got to tell you, from my point of view and from what I've read, it works. I don't know if you've done any research on Montessori program or anything.
Montessori is really fascinating. I've looked at a lot of different schooling systems, including Montessori. I've looked at most of the charter programs throughout the country. At the kids' schools and a number of others, I think it's a sensible approach. I mean, intrinsically makes sense. And if I look back at the experiences that I had in school, for instance, or even my experience with my parents, I mean, my parents exposed me and my brother to tons of different things until they found something we latched onto, and then all of the various sort of analytical approaches. All of the tools, the toolkits, were built on that interest that came about.
What was it for you that got you?
For me, it was marine biology. I mean, that's a fancy term for it. I wanted my mom would take me down to the beach, and we would we ate chicken wings and stuff like that a lot. And so we'd take these chicken wings or chicken legs that had already been mostly eaten and wrap twine around them and drop them down off the dock and catch crabs late at night and pull it up. And there'd be like 15 crabs on this chicken leg. And I just thought that was the most amazing thing I'd ever seen in my life.
Yeah.
And we'd also go down to one beach, and my mom showed me how to collect black sand with a magnet, right? And I thought that was the most amazing thing I'd ever seen. And
was your mom a marine biologist?
Not at all. My mom's a physical therapist,
right.
But was just, my parents were very good at exposing both of us to a lot of stuff. Mm-hmm. And we didn't end up doing the same things. I mean, I am very, I view myself as somewhat allergic to math, but my brother's, effectively a PhD in statistics. I mean, we went in completely different directions.
Wow.
And if you look at school, I think that one thing you brought up, and that is explaining the why, not just the what, is so important. And I actually almost got left back in kindergarten. And my teacher, Mrs. Bevan, was a bit of a tyrant. I mean, she made me eat soap. This is back. This is like
yeah, ma- nice.
Made, made kids eat soap.
Yeah, nice.
Because I was apparently, you know, too slow to learn the alphabet. Right, that was the conclusion. And she said to my mom, like, Tim's not going to survive first grade. There's no way. And got to first grade. Lo and behold, had this incredible teacher named Mrs. Vinsky, and she kind of looked at me and. She was a seasoned pro, and she looked at me and she's like, all right. I was the kid who wanted to lay down. Like I was like, but I'm done with this alphabet thing. I'm not learning the alphabet. And she was like, she goes, Tim, you know, if you learn to read the alphabet, you can read any book that you want to read. No one had told me that. And I was like, well, why didn't you fucking say that in the beginning?
And I
learned the alphabet in 2 days, and then I was like off to the races and went ballistic reading books, you know, because she was the first one. Aside from my parents, but to sort of explain the value of the alphabet.
The value of the alphabet.
As opposed to just...
Why it... And that, the problem is when I learned math, nobody gave me... I mean, nobody gave me even an inkling of how this was functional in the real world. I mean, you can't teach algebra to a 14-year-old like me. I was such a spaz to begin with. And expect me to... I'm in a New England boarding school freezing my ass off with a cold. And you... literally the word... I'd rather be at the dentist. I remember just saying this. I'd rather be at the dentist because at least there I get laughing gas.
But this is... I mean, this all comes back to the fact that the core of education is the student, but we don't act that way. Mm. You know what I mean? It's really like it's about... It's all about prior knowledge. What does the kid already know? Prior interests, like what gets the kid excited and all of that sort of stuff. And we don't deal with the student. Instead, what happens is we talk about legislation, we talk about teaching techniques, and we talk about, you know, how they need more money, they need more iPads, they need more resources. It's everything, everything around the student without actually talking to the kid.
How do you do that when you have that many kids?
Well, that's the point. You don't need to do that. You need to get the kid to be in charge themselves. You speak to the student and you – I mean, that's the thing. If you're a kid in Vietnam, you understand very, very clearly that the only way you're getting an education is if you take charge of that.
Yeah.
And we've basically eroded that idea.
Well, what's his name? Sergey – he won the TED Prize, the $1 million TED Prize. And he's a researcher. He leaves a computer in a village with a bunch of kids and says, I can't figure out how this DNA sequencing works, but maybe you can. Comes back 2 months later, and these kids have taught themselves everything with Google.
That's right. People are smart, but you have
to... including children.
Absolutely. And you need a culture that basically understands that, like, it's about individual human intelligence. It's about individual choices. It's about what you're doing. It's not about what the society is doing. It's about you.
Yeah. What, Tim, from your research, and Hunter's done a lot of research and wrote a great book about it, but from your research, what education systems are you the most impressed with?
The Finnish and Estonian school systems are actually very, very fascinating. The public school system in Finland, in Estonia, they're teaching elementary school kids to code, for instance, to program at a very young age. And that's looked down upon as just very hyper-utilitarian in some circles. But I think that language is never... unimportant. And you can teach someone a lot about how their own brain works by teaching them English, Spanish, or, you know, Python or Ruby on Rails or whatever it might be. So I find those two very, very interesting. I also like elements of other schooling systems. And I think that to skip to one of the maybe the punchlines is that if you can clone the best teachers in some fashion, that could be video, it could be YouTube, it could be through a startup like creativelive.com, which I'm involved with, where you can take some of the people who are the absolute best at not only teaching their craft, because that's a small piece of the puzzle, right? Not just excellent tacticians and technicians, but people who can get you over the top, excited about.
That's what I was going to say. Communicate with somebody.
You need to be able to inspire someone and get them so excited they're practically bouncing around in their seat to try something. Like, let me try, let me try, let me try. If you can't do that, the playbook, the toolkit, none of that stuff matters. Mm-hmm. So I do find elements of, say, there are some very highly utilitarian approaches to, say, math and so on, like Kumon from Japan. Very, very good. But Japanese teachers tend not to be very good at inspiring students. They're good at teaching material, not inspiring students. Then there are people in between. There are teachers in Korea, for instance, who literally teach to stadiums full of kids. I mean, there are like sold out sporting events, basically, for two kind of weird things in Korea, among others. You have StarCraft games. So you'll have two really good StarCraft players who will fight each other. There will be a sold-out stadium to watch this happen.
Wow.
That's crazy. And then number two, you will have teachers, right? English teachers who are literally making $4 to $5 million a year teaching stadiums full of kids. So I think that people in the U.S. and elsewhere should figure out what the hell is going on
here. Yeah, well, first of all, how are they able to get – that's a cultural thing where your children are taught from a very early age that you're going to learn – there are a couple things you're going to learn if you're Korean. You're going to be really good at an instrument, and you're going to be really good at, you know, at school. I mean, there's no – and that is part – there's no left or right turn here. Yeah. Math is hard. Sit down and work on it. You know, that feels like a cultural thing, you know. What do you think of that, Hunter?
Well, I think that's the thing. I think it's, you know, people tend to focus on cloning the best teachers. I think you clone the best students. Mm. You take somebody who really knows how to learn, you can give them, I mean, Enrico Fermi taught himself physics from a textbook that was in Latin. And, you know, he didn't speak Latin.
Smart guy.
You know, I mean, Benjamin Franklin, you know, again, gave himself a fantastic education from, you know, using the resources that he had. You know, William Kamkwamba, who's this kid in Malawi, who from a single book and a bunch of scrap built an electricity generating windmill. You know,
they're such a loser.
But I think that's the point, is just that that's really what's missing. And the difference between the United States and somewhere like Vietnam kicked our ass in the PISA test scores, which are the big international testing scores. They have a GDP per capita that is lower than the Republic of Congo. It's not that they have better teachers. It's not that they have more inspiring teachers. It's that they have students who are committed to learning. Mm-hmm. And what we need to do is we need to change the U.S. culture. And we can't wait around to figure out how to clone the best teachers, because what we need to figure out is we need to figure out how to change our culture so that we have a culture that embraces mistakes, where people understand that there is no mystery to learning. And they do the sort of things that are laid out in, the four-hour the four-hour chef.
That's where guys like Tim Ferriss come in, ladies and gentlemen, and Hunter Motz.
I think that's the point, Tim. I mean, you know, you don't need the greatest teacher. You can learn from any resource, no matter how boring it is, and you're smart enough. Like, for example, when you want to learn Japanese, you're like, great, what's going to work for me? A judo manual. That's how I'm going to learn Japanese.
So I would add to that that I think, and this is obviously not my quote, that sort of necessity is the mother of invention, right? Mm-hmm. So if you're in, say, and I've spent time in Vietnam building schools with room to read, if you're in the Mekong Delta, the difference between like your parents having food or not could be your education. So I think there's a very strong incentive. So how do you take a population that, not in all cases, but in many cases, is way past that point on Maslow's hierarchy of needs and incentivize them to improve themselves? It's actually a huge challenge. I think that in the United States, we're pretty fat and lazy and happy about it.
Yeah.
And so how do you deliver a shock to the system before we're all like house pets for Chinese diplomats? You know? Like,
yeah. It's one of the things that – it's one of the liabilities that comes with prosperity, I would
imagine.
I
think that's
we got to wrap this up.
But anyway, I think this goes back to what Tim was saying earlier, which is you create need. You choose a goal that is so big and so inspiring and so challenging that, you know, I mean, you look at someone
the
like
the magic of thinking big.
That's right.
Yep.
Yeah. And excellent. I think look at someone like Elon Musk. Elon Musk wants to terraform Mars. Like, he has no problem getting inspired, and he doesn't sit around and is bored all day. Like, his goal is big enough that, he's got
to get to work. I'm excited.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, talking to you guys gets me inspired, and hopefully that's what this podcast does, ladies and gentlemen. Tim, you can seriously come back any just let us know. I mean, let us know anytime
is,
you want.
This,
it's
this
always
is a blast,
blast,
man. Maybe I'll have you on the Tim Ferriss Show. I want to talk to you about stand-up sometime to really dig into it.
I'd love to
get amongst it with that.
I'm about to shoot my next special, so I'll let you know. That's my thing. So anytime you want, I'm available. I'm yours, and I can't tell you how much I appreciate you. Just come back anytime, for real. Just
awesome.
Anytime you call, we will make it happen. You're awesome.
This is amazing. Yeah, thanks for having me on, guys.
Thanks, bro. Tim Ferriss Show. It's Tim Ferriss. Get his books, The 4-Hour Body, 4-Hour Chef, and The 4-Hour Work Week. Outstanding stuff. Keep doing what you're doing, my friend.
Thank you, sir.
Talk to you soon.
All right. Thanks, buddy.
Later.
Bye-bye.
All right. Well, ladies and gentlemen, that's our show, and that was awesome. So thank you so much. Oh, by the way, I'll be doing stand-up. So go to briancallen.com. And apparently I'm the funniest.
You've been listening to The Brian Callen Show with Brian Callen. Be sure to like him on Facebook. Just search for Brian Callen Comedy. And follow him on Twitter. Just search for @BrianCallen. You can also find him online by visiting his website. Just go to briancallen.com. Until next time, bye-bye.